Welcome to Speducation, the special education podcast by Speducators and for Speducators, where we discuss all things related to special education, or as I like to say, Speducation, from the point of view of professionals working in the field. I'm Sarah Perkins, a nationally certified school psychologist currently practicing in a junior high in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Leanne McElwain. I'm a special ed teacher at an elementary school and have a background in secondary schools as well.
In this episode, we're going to talk through the book, Six Shifts to Improve Special Education and Other Interventions, A Common Sense Approach for School Leaders by Nathan Levinson. It was written in 2020. This book probably will end up taking more than one episode because we have lots of notes and lots of thoughts already. So we'll start here and we'll get through some of it and then we'll circle back in later episodes. So the reason I wanted to read this book is because our former director of special education for our district bought this book for all of the school psychologists. And about a year, maybe more ago, and it sat on my shelf and I didn't read it, part because I had opinions about our district leadership. But I thought, you know, if she thought it was interesting, it would be worth reading. Obviously, it was floating in the zeitgeist mm-hmm. of SPED leadership. So that's where it came from. I'll share a little bit of just history about the author. So he says that he was a special education student, but no one but his mom supported him in school. Then he became a businessman, and he joined a school board. And that was his first interaction with education on the professional side. And then as he worked on the school board, he got more interested in school leadership. And so he quit his job and became an assistant superintendent and worked for $1 a year. So obviously he was a successful businessman mm-hmm. if he was able to do that. And then he became a superintendent in a sounds like smallish community called Arlington, Massachusetts. And now he runs an educational consultant business or businesses maybe. And you can tell from his other books that he really is focused on sort of that governance piece. Like his other books are called Smarter Budgets, Smarter Schools, A Better Way to Budget, Spending Money Wisely, the District Management Council, which is his company, I believe. So they're really focused on that governance piece, except for this one, which I guess is looking at special education from that governance lens. So I think it's worth noting, disappointingly, it's yet another education book written by a non-educator.
Yes.
Which is a pet peeve of mine. But he does have background in school governance, so that's something. Yes. At least he's not just a random schmo.
And he is interested in tackling a multi-layered, complex challenge.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, general structure of the book. Obviously, it's called Six Shifts, so it's sort of structured around those six shifts. There's 9 chapters. There's an intro, like an outro, and then the other 7 chapters focus on the 6 shifts. One of the shifts gets 2 chapters because it's sort of a bugaboo. Yeah, so we'll just maybe start by talking through shift number 1. So the first shift is from special education to general education. So he sort of talks here about the history of special education. So he talks about how initially, of course, we all know it started as like segregated either schools or minimum classrooms where special education students went and sort of weren't seen again by the general population. And then started to move towards more inclusion and how that's been a focus lately. He does say, and I think he's right about this, that inclusion is often geographic inclusion, where the students are in the gen ed classroom, but not the responsibility of the gen ed teacher. And I feel like in our school system, we often see this with like the higher need students, like students with cognitive disabilities or emotional disabilities, where of course they would never go to a gen ed setting without a para, for example.
Right. Yeah. Like that's the belief of the building.
Yeah.
If they're in a gen ed setting, they have support that is specific to them.
Exactly. Then it says that the number one predictor of student achievement that schools can control, because the number one predictor of school achievement is actually socioeconomic status outside of schools. But setting that aside, the number one predictor that schools can control is teacher effectiveness. And it said the number one predictor of students with disabilities achievement is overall student achievement. So it basically sounds like what he's going at is that there's that effective general education teachers make the most difference with all students. And when all students are successful, that makes the most difference with students with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting, that he's sort of leaning on, like, I don't know, like the overall school performance rather than like the speducator effectiveness is what it vibed like.
Right. And it comes across to me as I read it that the person with the core content knowledge who is, you know, a professional or an expert in that area has the biggest impact on the student rather than a special ed teacher who comes in to provide intervention.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're exactly right. A powerful quote he had that stuck out to me that exactly mirrors what you just said is, while the evidence is strong that high quality, high rigor core instruction helps, there's also mounting evidence that special education services, when over applied, actually reduce outcomes. Mm-hmm. And that really stood out to me, which I knew. I don't know if you've heard me say it before, but I've said it in the classes I teach for University of Wyoming that I heard years ago, it's probably outdated, that there was a study that the overall effect size of special education is negative 0.3.
Right.
Which is moderately bad.
Mm-hmm. And when you consider the information around inclusion, we all know that when students are getting the general education instruction, then they're not having holes in their learning created. They need to be in the classroom to get the information, or it will naturally set them up to be behind.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. And I do think that it's worth considering that special education students, of course, are more at risk to begin with, which mm-hmm. impacts overall outcomes. But it's still a powerful statement.
Yeah, and it does support the same thinking of the least restrictive environment. You're only polling them for what has been indicated as necessity to keep them growing.
Exactly. Yeah. He also cites another study about on the bubble students, so students who are like borderline to qualify for special education services in nearby schools to each other. So some of those students got special ed services and some didn't. And what he says is the ones who got SPED achieved like SPED students, and the ones who didn't get SPED achieved like gen ed students, aka better.
Mm,
which,
fun.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just picked out this quote that he says, in more than a few schools, when general education takes the lead, referrals to special education drop, mm-hmm. sometimes by as much as half, and reading achievement rises. So that speaks to that idea of strong tier one instruction and meeting all kids at tier one.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and he talks about that too, which I know you and I have discussed mm-hmm. before, that one of his pet peeves is when interventions are taught by not highly qualified staff, especially like paras, mm-hmm. when often there are highly qualified staff in the building mm-hmm. and they're teaching the average or above average students and the intervention classes are being taught by the least
right.
capable. One thing that I think relates to our previous discussion on LRE that I liked that he pointed out is he said during IEP meetings, there's a lot of time spent discussing how much service time a student should receive and not much time on what the student will be missing. And I think that's true.
Yeah, I think people try to make it clear as to what will be provided and then inadvertently forget to talk about what they're missing. Yeah, which is, I mean, then it's hard to make a decision if we're not clear on that.
Right? And I think, I was going to say, especially at secondary, but I think actually at secondary and elementary, there's different nuances to that. But I think in both of them, it's sort of assumed that SPED will do everything Gen Ed is doing from what they're missing in Gen Ed and more.
Mm-hmm.
But that's clearly nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know you and I have had conversations like at the secondary level, at least in our system, if you end up in a SPED math class, that teacher is supposed to teach all of that grade level material and also do interventions with kids who, by definition, are not successful in math, probably resistant to math, and may have other difficulties like behavior, mm-hmm. which is clearly crazy
right.
to expect that they would do that. So I think part of the reason why we're not discussing what they're missing is maybe we're not being honest with ourselves about what they're missing. Because we are like, oh yeah, no, we'll make sure that they get everything they would have gotten.
Yeah, and I think maybe we do that in an attempt to be a problem solver rather than being a sticky wicket and having to say, oh, but by the way, just so you know, they're going to be missing these pieces of content instruction.
Yeah.
It seems to be where he's kind of covering that under the accidentally missing core instruction. Mm-hmm. They're getting pullout services, which we're happy about, but we don't want to talk about that they're missing that core instruction.
Exactly, yeah. I think you're exactly right. That's what is what he's going for. He does say, and I love this because I had a research teacher used to say this, that there's a myth that special educators have magic powers and mystical tools. And I had this research teacher I used to work with who would say, she would tell the general education teachers, like, I'm just a teacher. I'm not magic. And I always appreciated it when she said that. Because, of course, special educators have different training, but I mean, we're all people and we're all educators.
And I mean, it's worthwhile to point that out and say, I am not the content specialist. And if you're taking, you know, taking or adding space between someone's core instruction and the expert, you're going to end up with less than expert instruction.
Yeah, absolutely. He talks about being careful about push-in and co-teaching. And I know that you've had a lot of experience doing co-teaching, so I'd be interested in your opinion about that. Because he's saying that while it seems like a good idea, it can be not great in implementation. What has your experience with co-teaching been?
Well, my experience has been I have co-taught in English classes at the middle school level and then also co-taught in math classes at the middle school level. And both have been very challenging and disappointing in that it takes more than one school year to master and become truly a co-teacher with the other teacher. If scheduling changes and there's anything that interrupts the flow or, you know, from one year to the next, then you've lost it and you've got to start again. But it really takes a full year of going through that curriculum, working out the relationship bugs, and then determining whose part of instruction is whose, like what is the SPED teacher going to teach, what is the gen ed teacher going to teach. It's hard not to become a highly skilled paraprofessional versus the qualified teacher teaching in the room. I always felt that it was inappropriate for me to act as if I knew the content as well as the general education teacher knows the content. They truly went to school and had numerous hours of education in that area. My function and my expertise is working through SPED. So it was inappropriate for me, I felt like, to teach that content. What I wish I could have done is actually had shared planning with those teachers so that I could add multiple layers to their instruction that then benefited all students, but definitely the student that, or maybe, you know, three students that I was in the room for. So I wish I could have added some benefits that take time and require the same planning period with the other teacher, but I just rarely found that I could do that. It would have taken at least a second year with those same teachers to be able to get to that level.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one thing that you and I were discussing before we turned the microphone on is that a lot of this sort of circles back to scheduling, which is his shift number 5. So we will get there. But yeah, if you'd had the opportunity built into your day to spend more meaningful time with those co-teachers, you could have had more meaningful results.
Yes.
One explicit example that he gives a couple times throughout the book that I wanted to ask you about is he talks about how when there's a co-teaching model and or a para in the room, that what can happen is that if like a gen ed kid raises their hand to ask a question, the content teacher or the gen ed teacher stops they're teaching and answers their question and maybe addresses it to the whole group, but that when there's a SPED kid who raises their hand, the SPEDucator in the room will go and quietly answer their question just to them. And he thought this was a problem, one, because it deprives the whole group of learning what the answer to the question, and two, that then the whole group kept going. Mm-hmm. And so the SPED kid was left behind. Did you experience that phenomenon when you were teaching, co-teaching?
I did, and I think it was largely student-specific. So oftentimes you'll know what students are functioning close to the general education curriculum mm-hmm. function, or if they're already grade levels behind. And you'll get a sense, and you might function with this lens that, oh, this student is struggling to decipher the text versus having a true concept question. And so if you know one student asks those types of questions, you might not slow the whole group down to answer those questions. So it can be individual specific. And then the other piece, which I don't like to admit, but oftentimes I would not have the content answer. If my student would stop, you know, raise their hand, and then I go over to them and ask, oftentimes I wouldn't know the correct answer just because of not having much experience teaching that curriculum. And then I would have to circle around and go around the room trying not to disrupt, and then whisper in the teacher's ear or get some type of attention to say, oh, we need to go back and teach this. And so it was disruptive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and I have a co-teacher I work with this year, and he's co-teaching, I think, three different subjects
right.
with four different teachers.
Right.
And so he's told me the same thing. He said, I'm usually maybe reading the lesson plan at the start of class
yes.
that the teacher has. Mm-hmm. And so I have, you know, a two-minute head start mm-hmm. from the students on
right.
what we're doing that day,
right.
which makes it hard to answer meaningful questions.
Right. The best experience I had co-teaching was when I had both 7th and 8th grade math classes, and then I taught accommodated 7th and 8th grade, and I could be in both of those gen ed classrooms co-teaching and then teach my own accommodated 7th and 8th grade math classes because I could circle back to what was being taught in the gen ed class.
Yeah.
The worst experience I had co-teaching was when I was doing English 7th and 8th co-taught and math 7th and 8th co-taught. It's too much content for someone to know.
Yeah. But then the downside, I think, I've been talking with my principal about the schedule for next year, and she has been prioritizing allowing co-teachers to be in one subject, which is great, but then she's having them co-teach with multiple teachers. And when I said, hey, could they co-teach the one subject with one teacher, she said the problem with that is now you have a SPED core in your junior high. She's like, I don't love that. And I was like, well, I don't love that either.
And that is exactly what happens, because then you get that SPED core where the kids are funneled through, they stay with, you know, so is that inclusion?
Yeah. So not only is it like a gross LRE thing
right.
and like tracking, but also now you're putting all the difficult kids together to stew in a pot with each other,
yeah.
and they're just with each other all day long, mm-hmm. poking each other's buttons. So now you have more behavior issues. So not only are you like being exclusionary, you're also creating new problems.
Right. Point, and I think it's a nuance you don't understand until you start scheduling with those priorities, which the priorities are well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great way to go about doing it, but you don't have enough staff to create the diversity in teaching and offerings.
That is one thing I appreciate about this book, is that he doesn't discount those like higher level problems like scheduling,
mm-hmm. yeah.
which I think sometimes by educators who've maybe only we've worked with educators who've only worked at the classroom level, and they're like, I don't get why you just can't do it. And we're like, well, I invite you to sit down with the master schedule and explain to me why, how I can do it.
Right.
And at least he's recognizing that there is sort of a bigger picture mm-hmm. that interacts mm-hmm. with special ed in a way that is not intuitive to people who haven't looked at it from that, you know, that level, either people in the field or people outside the field who are looking in.
Right. Yep, I agree.
That is all I had for shift number one about moving from sped to gen ed. Is there any other thoughts you had about that one?
Boy, I mean, I have a lot of other thoughts that are going through my mind right now, but I do think we've hit the majority, you know, the top points, and talked about the struggles within trying to do the best work.
I will say, actually, I thought of something else that he sort of mentions throughout the book, is he mentions that sped teachers would say, well, but their IEP is not written that way. And he sort of says, well, then you just change the IEPs, which on the one hand, of course. But also I'm like, who's, like, you realize that's like man hours. And, you know, that changing any one IEP probably takes hours between the actual paperwork and then meeting with the parents. And then what if the parents object? Like, can you talk through that with them and probably arrive at a conclusion that everybody's happy with? Sure. But if you're doing that for the majority of the kids in a school, that's a big workload. And he doesn't quite ever address who's doing that. Mm-hmm. And how does that happen?
I mean, going through our current situation where we're having, you know, just some different structures put in place in our own district, and then looking at some different practices in our own district, what I have come to notice is that once you get through the initial rotation, then you are on that. Then you have completely changed that mindset. And then hopefully if you have administrators that stick with the decisions they make, you won't have to then go back and change the rest. But it's the hardest work, I think, in those situations is getting through that first year of IEPs and getting it structured and staffing and scheduling. I mean, it's multi-layered. But if you can, which I don't think happens in education much, but if you can keep your leadership on the same focus for long enough, you hopefully will be working under that pretense or that structure, and then reap the benefits in future years.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that stability of leadership and of like vision mm-hmm. would really go a long way. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right that we haven't necessarily had that recently. And so I think I'm more sensitive to hearing, oh, we'll just amend it, because then my thinking is it will never end. And you're right. If you did it once mm-hmm. and you had a clear vision, then mm-hmm. you would be done. Right. So that would make a bigger difference.
I'm just not sure that our nation is in a place that we will stay consistent with any educational reforms.
That, right.
Settling.
And then also, given our staffing shortages in SPED, even if the leadership stays the same, if our teachers are turning over, they will always be in that place of feeling like it's year one, because for them it would be year one. Mm-hmm. And I think that ideally, if we were to do like these shifts that he has in here, he does mention how SPED educators are overworked and are asked to do too much, which I found really validating and refreshing. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't quite get to how are we going to like honor the humanity and like the workload capacity of SPED educators moving through these shifts. Mm-hmm. And I think ideally that's what I'd like to see if a district were shifting, that they were centering the SPED educators and supporting them through that SPED shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting thought for a discussion after we go through the shifts, to then have a part that we discuss, like where we see opportunities for that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Absolutely. So we're taking a look at the self-assessment at the end of the chapter mm-hmm. for shifting from special ed to general ed.
Yes. And the first question is, are reading and math protected time with no pullout allowed?
Are they in your school?
In my school, yes, they are. I am in an elementary resource room setting, so I do know that tier one is sacred and I do not touch it.
I wonder if, is it hard though for a related service, do they pull out of that time, like speech? And I mean, OT doesn't
so
usually pull out.
Largely our building knows that we do not interrupt tier one instruction, and so I believe they work with the teachers whenever possible and pull out at times when science and social studies are occurring, maybe some independent reading time.
So they honor it pretty much too.
Yeah, and largely because we are instructed to do so
by your administrator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
because we know if you're not getting tier one, you're creating splinters and holes in the
absolutely.
Education.
So. And I would say at my school, they're absolutely not. We explicitly supplant tier one with SPED. Mm-hmm. At the secondary, like we'll have, like we talked about earlier, a SPED math class, mm-hmm. and then the kid does not have any other math class.
Mm-hmm.
So no, they are not protected, I guess is what I'm saying.
Right. And if you're in an accommodated class, which is out of the gen ed setting, yes, they're working under that curriculum map, but I mean, there's no guarantee that
yeah.
they are getting what the tier one gen ed setting is getting.
And sort of by definition, if they are, then they're probably not getting that much SPED.
Right.
Because you can't do both in the same
right,
amount of time.
Yeah, you can't create more time.
Yeah. So the second question is, are there formal written policies for when pullout can take place? I'd say in general in our district, we're not big on formal written policies.
Yeah, true.
Maybe that will change.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
So probably not, right?
Not.
Yeah.
Not often.
The next question is, do classroom teachers answer most questions when asked by students with a disability during co-taught or push-in periods, which is what we were talking about earlier?
Mm-hmm. My experience has been that it is, like, usually the special education person, whether that be a paraprofessional or a teacher, would think, we don't want to interrupt the class. Let's try to handle it on the side. Oftentimes, it can be a question that might relate to accommodations or something that isn't curriculum related.
Yeah,
but,
which is slightly different, but still.
I know, exactly. And it does send that kind of subtle or non-stated belief that this student is still separate.
Right, and that I'm, like, they have a different teacher.
Yes.
And I've noticed in my school this year that a lot of the co-taught teachers are starting to pull small groups very frequently, maybe even daily.
Mm-hmm.
And the small groups are exclusively the SPED students. And I had a co-taught teacher she has an exemption authorization. She's just started taking SPED classes. And she came and asked me, she's like, this is not LRE if I pull the SPED kids out of co-taught every day. And I said, you're absolutely right. And frankly, the reason I haven't said anything yet is because the capacity of the staff, I don't know if we're at a place in March to absorb changing our practices when everybody's trying to do their best. And I don't know that I'm personally at a place, so I've sort of let it lie. But I have been concerned when people are like, oh, I just pull them after the first 10 minutes every day. It's like, that's so there's no opportunity for a gen ed teacher to answer questions when the kids aren't in the room.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer, like, whether it says co-taught in their schedule or not, it's no longer a co-taught setting.
Right. And I'm wondering what's happening with the other students at that time. Is everyone
right.
working in a small group or?
I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd
yeah.
need to circle back to my teachers.
Yeah. What's the next
one? So the next one is, do classroom teachers feel they're primarily responsible for the achievement of students with special needs?
I don't know. I'm going to say unsure.
Yeah.
And I think that can even change within the co-teacher pairs based on the amount of experience and confidence that teachers have in their pairs.
Yeah.
And it's oftentimes like an agreement they have with one another.
I think you're right. And I think it comes down to those relationships. Also, like, I don't want to say personality, but the individual teachers and sort of their
mm-hmm.
philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also this larger cultural mm-hmm. concern on the building and district level. And I feel like in our district, there's maybe not a clear understanding that SPED kids are gen ed kids first. I'm hearing that language more. I feel
mm-hmm.
like I'm vaguely hopeful we're moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not necessarily seeing that shift in the teachers in my buildings.
Right. And in their practices, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and we haven't. Because we've been within such a changing environment over the last several years, you can't really get to that level of practice. Like, you can't look at what you're doing and ask why. You're really just doing.
Yeah, so. I completely agree.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of relates to the next question. Do you honestly assess and survey classroom teachers' beliefs about their roles serving students with mild to moderate disabilities? And I would say no. I haven't seen any assessment.
And usually what I see is a top-down type of structure to that, where administrators are sharing their perspective or what their, not beliefs even, but just in terms of how they build a schedule, how they speak about tier one,
mm-hmm.
and then you can glean from those practices how they feel, but you're never involved in that discussion.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. So the next one is, during co-teaching, does the general education teacher have small group instruction that includes students with disabilities? Whew.
So within my building, we have some intervention groups. So it's tier one intervention when students have demonstrated that they don't understand a concept. Our PLCs will meet and will group students. And we have data meetings every 3 to 4 weeks.
That's good.
And then we do switch groups. So in that way, that can happen.
That's really good.
Based on different standard skills. But it is interesting, this time of year, you find that groups are staying the same. Probably because rigor has increased throughout the year. There's less, like, you're no longer reviewing what was covered last year. You're going into some new material that is going to carry on into the following year, right? So that's where our PLCs have been tasked with really looking at who's teaching the skill well and making sure that the students that need to learn that skill are getting that teacher. We're just starting those conversations. Those are hard conversations to have. And then it has created a secondary issue for me, and that is, how do I get my special ed minutes? Mm-hmm. And so I can't create more minutes in a day, and it has been difficult. But
yeah,
obviously it's best to have that student with the teacher who's demonstrating the ability to teach that skill the best.
Absolutely. It sounds like your school is a lot further than my school, which I think in our district, the elementary schools tend to be further than the secondary in general. In fact, and even I've had former directors, seeing as our current director's only been here 8 weeks, but former directors tell me, oh yeah, no, we're not going to worry about secondary now. Like whenever we're talking about shifting things, it's like, yeah, no, that's too hard. Which it's like, well, 2/3 of our kids are secondary.
Right, exactly.
So, but yeah, it does sound like your school is moving along there. The next one is, do you ask teachers about their skill and comfort in teaching students with learning disabilities? I will say this is something that I really want to, hopefully, depending on what happens in my building and leadership and everything, I'd really like to focus on next year because I do think that our general education teachers are communicating to us that they are not comfortable and that they do not feel they have skills. And we haven't necessarily been responding. We've been trying to respond with support. For example, we were supposed to have like staff development and it had to be rescheduled because there was a sub shortage and we couldn't pull the teachers to do it. We had to reschedule it twice. So this will be our third effort after spring break to try to have it. So keep your fingers crossed that we get subs, but I'm not,
right.
I'm assuming we probably won't.
Yeah. And it's such a long process, you know, to get to address comfort. First it's, you know, informational, then it's experience and exposure, and then every child is different. And so it can be, you know, they become comfortable with one student, but then a student with different needs, they're not as comfortable. It's such a challenge. But the main thing, and what I take from that, is actually having conversations around it.
Yeah.
And allowing teachers, like asking teachers what their comfort level is. At this point, it's kind of, my experience has been a don't ask, don't tell. We're just going to assume that you're comfortable.
Yeah, because we don't have time to train you or help you.
It's not cool, or it's not okay to not be comfortable.
Yes. The defensiveness is really high right now. In our setting, and so it's hard to admit what you don't know.
And I would say, I mean, I guess this is my perspective and my lens showing, but I would say I wouldn't want to be somebody that says I'm not comfortable working with a student with a disability, because that would leave me vulnerable and perhaps show some of my bias. And then, like, then I'm really vulnerable because I've told you I'm not comfortable.
Yeah.
So inadvertently, I think what we do is we don't ask and we don't slow down and take the time to discuss it and address it like you are. So kudos with actually trying.
Yeah,
to
hopefully.
to address it. But then we, you know, we scoot past it, and then we end up giving the people who have a natural skill for it all of the kids. And we make the other people, you know, we get resentful and say, oh, the only ones that do it are the people that have agreed to do it.
Yeah.
Never build capacity.
And you can burn out if you always give the one teacher who's great with everybody all the hard kids,
right.
You might not keep that teacher.
Right.
The other thing that we've had happen at our school is we have this one kid who's really struggling right now, and our teachers are saying, we can't teach her. She needs professional help. And we're like, agreed. We are the professionals she has.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And like none of us, like nobody knows exactly how to help this kid. We all agree she needs more than we can do. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, mm-hmm. she's in our school and we have to figure it out. And like, which professional do you think is magic here? Because none of us are. And so it falls back. There's like enormous pressure on my social worker and my speech language pathologist to like fix this kid.
Yeah.
And they keep saying, well, I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I don't either. I mean, we all agree she's at risk. She's struggling. Mm-hmm. She's not being successful. Mm-hmm. But the answer isn't get her out of my classroom because she needs professional help. It's
right.
Like, yes. And also, this is what we have.
Right.
So that's
hard.
I
think later in this book, he kind of addresses like behavioral issues.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we'll talk more about that.
And I think I'll be thinking about the same student during that time,
yes.
too.
Yeah.
And then the last question is, do classroom teachers get pedagogical? Pedagogical?
Sure.
Pedagogical. Thank you.
Yeah.
Coaching. At least a few times each month.
A few times each month? Who has time for that?
No one has time for
Nobody's
that.
Nobody's got time for that.
That sounds lovely.
Right. Do classroom teachers get... So, I'm trying to think. I think sometimes we can get some of that in a staff meeting. I think sometimes we can get some of that in a professional development day. That's reaching.
Yeah.
And that's not three times each month.
No.
I don't know that my brain can even handle three times each month.
I think maybe it would feel more doable if what it looked like was another educator brainstorming with you. Like maybe coming and hanging out while you're doing a thing and then brainstorming about how to make that thing go better next time.
Yeah.
I think that would make it more doable. I do know. I feel like lately it all comes back to subs at least at my school, because my school, work at a Title I junior high school, subs are not picking my school.
Mm-hmm.
When they have a range of options, they don't go, sign me up for the teenagers in the Title I right. school. And so our teachers aren't even getting planning mm-hmm. often because they're subbing, which they get paid for, and some of them really need that money and enjoy that, which is great. But obviously they can't have those conversations, even those informal conversations with, hey, how did you teach that thing today? Because I thought that was weird and I sort of struggled. And those conversations, let alone actual formal coaching, mm-hmm. aren't happening because they're teaching the entirety of the day.
Right. So do your teachers content-wise have PLCs?
They do.
Scheduled?
But again, I think, I mean, the sub situation is really dire.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that they're even getting to do those.
Okay.
Because we're, I'd say, regularly short a minimum of 5 or 6 subs every day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a lot of coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And so then even if the PLC meets, one person is subbing in French class. I don't think we have French class this year. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, and so the group's incomplete. And that one person's missing out, and that group's missing out, and that one person's expertise. And frankly, the people who are volunteering to mm-hmm. cover during their planning are the more skilled teachers.
Right.
Because they can afford to,
right.
Which means they're depriving their colleagues of their expertise in any of those meetings.
And that just becomes, should become, and likely is a concern of the admin in the building.
Yeah.
Because if your teachers are just constantly being shorted, that afforded that opportunity to PLC and discuss their practice, they're just not getting that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the ways we're addressing it in our building, I was thinking about this as you were speaking. We have one of our building focuses is using Kagan structures to increase learning
mm-hmm.
and building community within our building. So our principal has identified 2 staff members who are Kagan experts or, you know, highly interested in Kagan and have, you know, been trained and demonstrated capacity in that. So they get a sub for 1 half day each month, and then those teachers go and observe other teachers using Kagan structures in their classroom. And there's to avoid having a long conversation, they have a form that they fill out, and it is not evaluative at all.
Yeah.
These other teachers just give you comments and say what you're doing well and then suggestions, and it's very kind and gentle. And
that's, you know, nice.
I still get nervous when they come. Well. But it's something that is a breath of fresh air. It does give me another focus of like, oh yeah, I could be using these structures that have been proven, you know, to provide benefits.
I like that. So that's nice.
That is a nice way. But again, they have to have subs to be able to get out of their classroom and share their expertise.
We did, now that I think about it, you sparked my memory. We were trying something where our site coordinator and our district sped teacher coach were going to go into co-teaching classrooms and observe and give feedback, hopefully in a nice way, like you were describing. But there were a couple of downsides. One, there were no subs, so often both co-teachers weren't in the class at the same time because one was pulled to sub. And two, there was poor communication with the general education teachers, so they weren't aware that they were coming, and this caused a lot of drama.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, even in the best situation, you get nervous, but if you don't know why they're in your room, and a lot of these general education teachers are also new and maybe not super secure, that caused a lot of stress. And so between that and the lack of coverage, I think it sort of dwindled away. I should follow up and see if that's still happening.
Yeah.
But given that also both of those professionals are changing for next year, I'm not sure what kind of buy-in there's going to be either from them or from people listening to them going, oh, well, you're not going to even be in that role next year.
Right.
We'll see.
And honestly, that's one of those things that will anybody even remember next year that it was something you were trying to do?
So, right.
But I've been in that situation where I have had observations of my co-teaching. And one thing that I really needed in that situation was, again, communication with both teachers, obviously, to know, but then a clear target. What is it that you're looking for, or what are we shooting for as a team?
That makes sense.
And it just helps to not feel like you're under a magnifying glass for every piece of it.
That really makes sense to me. Yeah. Otherwise, it's too much. Okay, so next time we'll talk more about shift number two.
Yeah.
Education.